John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for knots, oh no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQTRadio@hushmail.com, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Thursday, March 3rd, 2011. Israeli soldiers abducted on Wednesday evening Hamas legislator Azam Salhab, 54 years old, from the southern West Bank city of Hebron, after stopping him at a military roadblock near Jericho City. There are currently 9 elected Hamas legislators imprisoned by Israel, in addition to 2 Fatah legislators and 1 from the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. The legendary folk singer Pete Seeger, an icon of the folk movement of the 1950s and 60s, told an Israeli organization that he supports the movement for boycott, divestment and sanctions of Israel, quote, as much as he can. This position is a shift from Seeger's earlier stance in support of an online event sponsored by the Zionist Jewish National Fund in support of the Arava Institute, a graduate institution in Israel. Seeger supported the event when it took place last year, but later critiqued his own decision, saying that he had not fully understood the extent to which the Jewish National Fund provided financial backing for Arava. Kirbatana, north of Nablus, has been demolished for the sixth time on Wednesday after residents recently rebuilt it. Early in the morning, 20 structures, including homes, were demolished by 3 bulldozers under the protection of the Israeli military. The military presence included 13 patrol cars. The Israeli military began their attack against the village in 2005 and claimed that the temporary structures that housed 200 persons must be demolished due to the lack of permits issued to the village. Israeli settlers have launched a day of rage in protest against the demolition of a handful of illegal structures in the Havat Gilad outpost. Demonstrators briefly succeeded in blocking the main highway between Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. Separately, demonstrators set fire to tires outside Jerusalem, and another group sought to block the rail link between Modin and Ben-Gurion Airport. This action caused some train delays. Israeli police arrested on Thursday citizens who were present in the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem. At the time of publication, the identities of those detained and their location are unknown. The Research and Documentation Unit at the Jerusalem Center for Social and Economic Rights reported that Israeli soldiers and policemen have kidnapped more than 80 Palestinian children in occupied East Jerusalem since the beginning of the year. 40 of these children are from the Silwan district. Following the recent increase in attacks by Israeli settlers on indigenous Palestinians in the West Bank, the Palestinian Authority issued a statement on Wednesday, calling on the international community to, quote, intervene with Israel over the violent and provocative actions by settlers, which the Israeli authorities refuse to control. That sums up our news for today. Thank you for joining us from Occupied Bethlehem. You've been listening to Palestine Today from the International Middle East Media Center. For more updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. This report has been brought to you by Hussam Kassis and Sakari Pahizia.
Afghanistan yesterday, after rockets landed on U.S. forward operating base Blessing in eastern Afghanistan, a U.S. airstrike killed 9 Afghan children gathering firewood in Konar's Dara-e-Pesh district. This after another recent airstrike killed 64 civilians. Remember that famous photo from Vietnam of the young girl covered in napalm burns? Apparently little has changed since then. U.S. General Petraeus is apologizing for the airstrike, but not everyone considered it enough. Frankfurt International Airport, Germany, yesterday. An Albanian Muslim fighter opened fire on a busload of U.S. Air Force servicemen. He killed 2 of them and wounded 2 more before being tackled. As he fired at the U.S. Air Force, and even after being taken down, he was shouting, Allahu Akbar, meaning God is great, at the top of his lungs. Nobody has said anything to confirm nor deny any linkage to the airstrike that killed 9 children in Afghanistan the same day. The wheel is round, and what comes around goes around, especially in war. Baghdad, Iraq, yesterday. A roadside bomb hit a U.S. convoy on Al-Qanat Street in eastern Baghdad without leaving casualties, according to a security source. Dhikar Province, Iraq, Tuesday. A Pakistani driver was injured when a roadside bomb exploded near a U.S. military convoy in southeastern Iraq, according to police. Iraqi police said the explosion happened on a road between Dhikar and Basra in the Abda River region south of the city of Nasira. It said the blast was caused by an explosively formed penetrator, a special type of shaped charge designed to penetrate armor effectively at standoff distances. What's this? U.S. convoys still being hit with explosively formed penetrators in Iraq? Whatever happened to U.S. combat operations in Iraq are over? Oh yeah, that's been said before. Mr. Barack Obama, now's the time to put an end to this river of blood. Bring all the troops home today.
And no amount of money you could give me, honey, couldn't pay me, ain't going back again.
Those army recruiting ads had to have side effect warnings like drug advertisements on TV do.
The United States Army may not be right for every patient. Side effects can include distress, disillusionment, bitter resentment, isolation, traumatic and post-traumatic stress, sociopathic behavior, uncontrollable sobbing, uncontrollable violence, prosecutions for war crimes, prosecutions for domestic crimes, loss of contact with loved ones, loss of ability to love, brain injuries, blindness, depleted uranium poisoning, flashbacks, horror of death, horror of being away from death, loss of the use of limbs, loss of limbs, death, suicide, excruciating pain, the desire to feel excruciating pain, overwhelming rage and misery, loss of hearing, punishment by the Army for failure to obey illegal orders, punishment by courts of law or by enemy forces for obeying illegal orders, torture, humiliation, shame, dangerous habits of blind subservience, or the wasting of what could have been the best years of your life. If you experience any of these symptoms, deal with it, sucker. You already signed your name on the dotted line.
Widespread protests challenging autocratic regimes and monarchies across the Middle East and North Africa have now spread from Tunisia and Egypt to more than 10 other countries throughout the Middle East. However, the worst violence in this wave of unrest is now occurring in Libya, where the embattled leader Muammar Gaddafi, in power for 41 years, is engaged in a pitched battle with large numbers of his people allied with former members of the nation's military. Violently repressed protests in major cities soon devolved to an armed revolt, with large portions of Libya's territory now under the control of anti-Gaddafi rebels. The U.S. and United Nations have responded to the crisis by demanding Gaddafi step down from power and leave the country. The U.S. has imposed a freeze on Libya's U.S.-based assets, and the European Union is enforcing an arms embargo. But governments across the world are growing concerned about the potential for this surge of regional dissent to reach another country, the oil-rich kingdom of Saudi Arabia. The world's number one exporter of petroleum with the largest oil reserves, Saudi Arabia is a theocratic state where religious police strictly enforce Sharia law. Beheadings are common and women have few rights. Although political parties and protests are banned in the country, there are signs that opponents have become bolder in their demand for change. Dozens of people were detained in January for engaging in protests in the city of Jeddah. A group of activists were jailed for openly announcing the formation of an opposition political party, and 100 academics have publicly called for sweeping reform. Now, activists using Facebook are trying to organize protest rallies across Saudi Arabia on March 11th and 20th. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with T. Kumar, advocacy director with Amnesty International. He discusses human rights conditions in Saudi Arabia and why he believes the U.S. and other nations around the world should immediately pressure the Saudi royal family to relinquish autocratic rule and establish a constitutional monarchy.
The human rights situation in the country is extremely disturbing. There are several hundreds, if not thousands, political prisoners there. Executions are common, beheading are common. Women in particular face numerous restrictions. They can't drive, and their upward mobility, even treating as equals, is not even heard of there. It's pretty much a controlled society. Media freedom is extremely limited. No opposition parties are there. No meaningful elections takes place. So you are talking about the similar situation that existed, say, in Egypt, Tunisia, or Libya. The only exception is they were ordinary people who were in power as dictators. Here, a kingdom, a king is there. They have dictatorial powers. So it's basically they are kings, but everything they have is the same thing that the other regimes that fell.
T. Kumar, how significant are the recent petitions, online petitions taken up, calling for a constitutional monarchy, opening up of the system, where there are also recent demands for new political parties to emerge? The regime has reacted by arresting dozens of people. And just recently, there's a Facebook call in Saudi Arabia for protest rallies on March 11th and 20th. How significant are these recent events in Saudi Arabia?
It's extremely significant. In this time of age, they can't block information coming out from different parts of the world, especially from the neighborhood. Facebook, Twitter, emails, you name it. We saw the uprising in Egypt, Tunisia, as well as Libya. Pretty much people came to know that their fellow Arab brothers are rising up against authoritarian regime. So now they also have the same motivation, and they also try to ask for regime change or in some cases only concessions organized through Facebook and other means. So it's not isolated. Saudi Arabia cannot be isolated from other issues that are happening, other revolutions that are happening in the neighborhood. And it's already having impact.
What's your guess as to how strong opposition groups are within Saudi Arabia and the effect of them coming into the streets against strict orders of the monarchy and their police?
If you see what happened in Egypt, Tunisia, or Libya, there you didn't have any opposition movements. The only opposition movement in Egypt was the Islamic Brotherhood, which technically had roughly 20-30% of support according to different sources. So you don't need to have an organized opposition movement to rise up. In Saudi Arabia, even though there are no meaningful opposition parties, that does not mean that there will not be any large-scale demonstrations or public anger spilling out into the streets. You can't predict, but if you analyze other countries, you can't rule out it will not happen.
For many decades, the United States has had a very close relationship with the Saudi regime, and certainly the United States has sold billions of dollars worth of armaments, high-tech weapons such as fighter jets and other hardware such as tanks. How would you like to see the United States change its policy toward Saudi Arabia, given the upheaval around the Middle East and the winds of change blowing there? The growing calls for people all over the world for the United States and other major powers to stop supporting autocratic and dictatorial regimes.
It is in the U.S. interest, long-term interest, to support genuine democratic reforms in Saudi Arabia and other countries. If the U.S. takes a different line because of Iran or because they need support from Saudi Arabia for a variety of issues, including economic, that means oil, and fighting against so-called terrorists, then they'll be mistaken. It's a short-term victory that they will have. Long-term, people are going to rise up if there are no meaningful reforms. So it's better for the United States to come quickly before there are people on the streets and getting killed. So they should push for meaningful reforms right away and condition any aid, military aid or anything, on the assumption that they will improve democratic reforms, protect human rights, and give an equal rights to everyone. So it's better for the U.S. to get ahead of the curve and be with the people in Saudi Arabia.
That was T. Kumar, Advocacy Director with Amnesty International. Contact the group by calling area code 212-807-8400. Or visit their website at amnestyusa.org.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
On the 25th of February, over 1,000 supporters of the embattled public service trade unions in Wisconsin gathered in DuPont Circle to denounce Governor Scott Walker of Wisconsin and his draconian attempt to break the back of unions by taking away the right of public sector workers to organize a union in Wisconsin. Don't think these problems are only in Wisconsin either. One of the speakers in DuPont Circle spoke of the struggle at Washington Hospital Center, where there's going to be a strike on Friday because the bosses there are trying to do the exact same thing, break the back of the union.
We're all behind them. But I need to let people know that it's not only healthcare and healthcare workers in Wisconsin that are under attack, but healthcare workers right here in the nation's capital. On Friday afternoon, 1600 of my colleagues and I will be walking out of Washington Hospital Center at 6 a.m. We will be staging a one-day strike, and we beg your indulgence to attend and to assist us in our efforts to get in the way of their efforts to manage engagement there. They drafted a Midwesterner, a known and accomplished strikebreaker, to come in. For 8 months, we've been without a contract. Come in and immediately establish and institute their own new terms and conditions in violation of our contract. Boo, boo, boo! To no avail. We were left no option but to call a one-day strike Friday. They would more than likely lock us out for the rest of the week. So at 12 noon, at First and Irving Northwest, you can join several thousand of us who will be protesting there against the onslaught of healthcare in general, all of your well-being. For 30-some years, I've been taking care of people just like you. Please come and take care of us on Friday at 12 noon.
Following day, the 26th of February, Governor Scott Walker of Wisconsin had the nerve to show up here in D.C. at the J.W. Marriott on 14th Street for the National Governors Association Convention. And there he was confronted by protesters outside, including no less than Governor Shumlin of Vermont, who spoke at the rally himself. There he is.
I just want to say this. You all are the backbone of America. I think you have to
Governor of Vermont, Shumlin.
I think what America wants is thoughtful leaders working together with labor.
That's right.
To make America a better place, to grow jobs and grow our economy, and make it a better opportunity for our children. Now, this is what I suggested to my friend Governor Walker and others. In Vermont, we know that we get more with maple syrup than we do with vinegar. But I just want to say that not all governors are born the same. And together, we rely upon you, upon labor, upon the ability to collectively bargain, which is a basic human right in a democracy. We're just here to say, keep on keeping on and thinking from the future for America.
Later that night, Sunday night in Wisconsin, the Wisconsin State Police tried and failed to get protesters to leave the Wisconsin State Capitol, which as this is being recorded, was still under occupation by protesters, insisting it's a so-called budget repair bill that would require annual decertification elections for public employee unions and forbid bargaining over anything other than wages outright be scrapped. Many people at protests over Wisconsin, in Wisconsin, here in D.C., and everywhere in between have been comparing this struggle to Tunisia and Egypt.
For more than 2 weeks, large numbers of Wisconsin union members and their supporters from across the U.S. have converged on the state capitol in Madison to protest Republican Governor Scott Walker's effort to slash state workers' rights. On Saturday, February 26th, an estimated 100,000 pro-union demonstrators swarmed the Capitol building, making clear that the outcome of the fight over union collective bargaining rights in Wisconsin will have consequences far beyond the state's borders. Similar efforts by Republican governors to diminish union rights are underway in Ohio, Indiana, Florida, and Tennessee. Even though Wisconsin unions had agreed to all of Governor Walker's proposed salary, health insurance, and pension cuts to address the state's $137 million budget gap, Walker has refused to back down on his demand to take away most state employees' collective bargaining rights. 14 Democratic state senators who left Wisconsin in mid-February to deny the GOP-controlled Senate a quorum and a vote on the governor's anti-union legislation remain out of state in Illinois. Several recent national public opinion polls have found that a majority of Americans oppose the Republican governor's campaign to take away collective bargaining rights from labor unions. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Matthew Rothschild, editor of the Progressive magazine, which is based in Madison. He assesses how local and national unions have responded to Governor Walker's challenge and the capacity of these historic protests to re-energize the labor and progressive movements nationwide.
Actually, the amazing thing is there's been a sit-in and a sleep-in and an occupation of the state capitol building for 12 nights now. That's gone underreported. And also underreported is just the sustained magnitude of these protests. 10 to 12 days ago on a Tuesday, there were 10,000 people, and it just gradually built up from there till a Saturday ago, there were 75,000, and this Saturday, there were 100,000. These are sustained mass protests for union rights, the likes of which we haven't seen in this country since the 1930s, and yet the corporate media has not given it its due.
From your perspective, Matthew Rothschild, what is the bottom line in what this fight is about? Republican Governor Scott Walker says his objectives are for long-term sustainability with the state budget, says the state of Wisconsin is broke. But of course, it's a lot more about unions, their power to negotiate, and his effort to really eviscerate public employees' unions' ability to engage in collective bargaining.
Yeah, it's not a budget bill at all. It's a union-busting bill. In fact, all the concessions he's asked from the unions for budget cuts, they've already agreed to. They agreed to take cuts in the health care benefits. They agreed to put more into their pensions than they had been before. Actually, they agreed to the amount that he was proposing just to call his bluff. And it became clear when he didn't accept their concessions that what he's after isn't solving a budget problem, which isn't that great anyway, and he's made greater by giving tax breaks to his buddies and sending back $800 million in high-speed rail money that the federal government wanted to give him, but he doesn't care about that. What he wants to do is get rid of the unions, and he's trying to get rid of the unions in a couple specific ways. First, he's getting rid of some people who would be eligible for the union, public sector unions like limited-term employees at the university. But the two primary ways he's assaulting the unions in this bill have nothing to do with saving the state a dime. One would require annual recertification votes for every single public sector union, and that never happens. I mean, when you join a union, you get a majority of people to sign a union card, and you're a union and you don't need another election until a majority of union members say, we want to decertify. But he would require a new election every single year, which would tie the union up in knots. And secondly, he would defund the unions by making it illegal for any public sector employer, not just the governor, but any county exec or mayor, from deducting union dues from people's paychecks. And that's the primary way that unions get their money. They deduct the dues out of people's paychecks. So this is just a very Machiavellian way to strangle unions. And the mainstream corporate media haven't really spelled out these specific ways that they're trying to do it. So it all seems kind of fuzzy. But once you lay it out like that, it's obvious this isn't about budget cuts or saving money. This is about destroying unions. Now, why do they want to destroy the union? They want to destroy unions for a political reason, because unions typically are supporting the Democratic Party, and this is a Republican governor. But it's much deeper than that. It's a primary economic motive of corporations and the Republican Party to get rid of unions so that people would be forced into a race to the bottom and have to go hire themselves to the most abusive employer who pays the worst wage and doesn't offer any benefits. That's paradise as far as corporate America goes.
Matthew, when you look at President Obama's, what I think many would characterize, tepid response in terms of only saying a few words about these massive protests in the big fight for labor union rights, what's the feeling on the ground in Madison about Obama and what he pledged to do when he ran for president, which was to stand by working people?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of disappointment that the president hasn't shown more vocal support. I mean, we've all seen a clip of him saying the year before he got elected, while he was on the campaign trail talking to a union group, that, you know, if there's a picket line somewhere in America, when he's president, he's going to get his walking shoes on and join the picket line. Well, he's 2,000 miles from the picket line here. You know, he could stand up and be more forceful in his speech. He could come out here. He could send Joe Biden out here, certainly. I mean, that wouldn't have cost him a thing. And yet, we're not seeing a lot of national figures out here other than Jesse Jackson. And the people who've been out on the line here for 10 days, 12 days, now almost 2 weeks, need that kind of reinforcement. And so when Jesse Jackson was here inside the Capitol, that was tremendous. Or when Ed Schultz on MSNBC was broadcasting from here, that was tremendous. But certainly getting the full force of the President of the United States, who was put in power by progressives, put in power by union people, certainly would be something that would be welcome here, to say the least.
A lot of people looking at the enormous outpouring of solidarity and militant protest in Wisconsin are seeing a spark that could be fanned into a fire, noting that working families in this country have suffered a loss of income, stagnation over a whole bunch of decades since the Reagan tax cuts for the rich. The tax cuts seem to be, you know, continuing on under President Obama. Do you think what's happened in Wisconsin could be that spark to move progressives and labor unions away from a defensive position to go on the offense against policies which are redistributing wealth upwards from the poor and middle class to the wealthiest sector?
I do think this is a huge watershed event, because up until now, people were just taking it lying down. You know, there are 15 million, 16 million people officially unemployed and have been for a couple years now, and they haven't been in the streets. There are 5 million or 6 million people who've been thrown out of their houses because of the shenanigans of the Wall Street bankers, and they haven't been out in the streets. The middle class has gained no income, really, in real terms over the last two or three decades, where the top 1% is made out like bandits, and still people haven't been in the streets, still taking it lying down. But finally here in Wisconsin, people aren't taking it lying down. And then around the country, we saw all these solidarity rallies this weekend, which shows that people are really waking up. And that's why I think ultimately Governor Walker will go down as someone who terribly misplayed his hand for corporate America, because corporate America would rather rip people off while they're sleeping than wake people up and fight them over it. And now they got a fight on their hands.
That was Matthew Rothschild, editor of the Progressive Magazine, based in Madison, Wisconsin. Read the magazine's coverage of the pro-labor protests in Wisconsin at progressive.org.
On Valentine's Day, public housing tenants and supporters showed up outside the Russell Senate office building opposing GOP plans for massive, massive budget cuts for public housing that would throw at least 750,000 people out of the street. I can't imagine anything more likely to destabilize American cities and set up an Egypt-style uprising than throwing so many people out of their homes into the street.
Right-wing of the Republican House leadership is hijacked by extremists.
That's right.
And it won't be without bad and grave consequences that public housing units won't be preserved. The House Republicans have proposed cutting the public housing preservation program by 40%. And if you don't live in public housing, they're coming after your program tomorrow.
Right.
Is there another federal housing safety net? No. This is our federal housing safety net. We're here to call on the Senate to unequivocally reject the House cuts to public housing, to all housing programs. The House leadership on Friday night suggested to cut the HUD budget by $5.7 billion. These are our communities, these are our neighborhoods, these are our children, these are our grandparents. We say no, we call on the Senate to reject.
Housing, we will fight. We the people have the right. Cut housing, we will fight.
So we all have somewhere to stay, because you cannot put the people in the streets. We need our kids to have somewhere to stay. Y'all build all these million-dollar stadiums. Y'all do all these things in the community.
Several speakers went so far as to invoke the Egyptian revolution as an example of what can happen with these kind of cuts.
Egypt and Yemen and happening over there in the Middle East and, you know, in North Africa. And, you know, I'm jealous.
So how come this Congress right here, they always find money for war? We're spending $320 billion every day on a war in Afghanistan that we can't even win. $320 million for housing for people who need homes.
Education.
Money for housing, not for war. That is what we're fighting for. Money for housing, not for war. That is what we're fighting for.
Money for housing, not for war.
That is what we're fighting for.
A lot of people waiting to go in and talk to some of these members of Congress about the housing issues.
Chocolate City, this is movement music.
Have you heard the news?
Walmart's coming.
Georgia Avenue, uptown, ain't that something?
Something.
Small businesses, shop owners, hearts pumping, cause they know their livelihoods is about to take a thumping.
Thumping.
See, you can't compete with a superstore who's an importer of slave laborers. Craftsmanship, low price to flip to undercut the market. Hand over fist.
Walmart
is infamous for the way they behave. Low wage pay, treat the workers like slaves. Employees who try to unionize, soon find themselves in unemployment lines. The way they treat women needs improving. 1.6 million sisters are suing them for being paid less than the male equivalent. On these issues and more, we can't afford to be ignorant.
Keep DC Walmart free. It won't benefit you or me. They ain't about spreading love in the community. They ain't about Chocolate City unity. Opportunists stop to make a buck quick. Suck up all your resources and then they split. They try to come across as if they legit, but really their motives are counterfeit.
This is the Funkinest Journalist with your three Walmart commandments. Step one, move in and crush competition by underselling. Step two, pay workers nothing and block unionization. Step three, take all that money, put it into the Walton Family Foundation, and turn that into political influence to protect yourself and make even more.
Walmart, it's not a good fit for Chocolate City. Let me holler black at you with the skinny. Important that you clearly understand and remember DC doesn't work with the right wing agenda. The Walton families are big contributors to bigoted representatives and senators. Trent Lott, sinister. Strom Thurmond, similar. Confederate state loving George Bush ministers. Overseer plantation mentality results in black and brown casualties. Statehood opposition for the district has been supported by Walmart's mischief. The D.C. Voting Rights Act was defeated, assisted via Walmart PACs. And now they want to come here to see their money stack. Stay up on the facts. Chocolate City, don't relax and fight back.
Keep D.C. Walmart free. It won't benefit you or me. They ain't about spreading love in the community. They ain't about Chocolate City unity. Opportunists stop to make a buck quick. Suck up all your resources and then they split. They try to come across as if they legit, but really their motives are counterfeit.
D.C. Walmart Free is an emerging activist group of D.C. residents stepping up to challenge the corporate big box invasion of Chocolate City. Walmart has plans to establish 4 stores in D.C. by 2012. Walmarts in D.C. will threaten small businesses, cause loss of more jobs than it will bring to the community, and lower the wage standards for all workers. To find out more and get involved, visit walmartfreedc.org.
On the 15th of February, ANC Single Member District 6C01 held a public meeting on the subject of Walmart coming to D.C., in particular on the subject of the New Jersey Avenue location. I guess it's appropriate the meeting is being held in church, considering we're talking about a corporation that's trying to turn the whole city into an economic hell.
I am a community member of the single member district. I am currently unemployed, and would I want a Walmart job? No, because I left DCPS unemployed back in June of 2009. back in 2009, and even the wage they were paying me wasn't a livable wage. I live in affordable housing, and I know what it is to basically just pay bills and just make ends meet. Basically, the paycheck Walmart will give them will go back to Walmart. So who is truly benefiting? I have an aunt in South Carolina works for Walmart, and trust me, full time. And guess who covers her? Her ex-husband still carries her on his insurance, her and her two sons. So I know a thing or two about Walmart.
My name is Asantua Ntumatule. I'm a member of the TDC Walmart Free Community Coalition. I'm also a member of Plymouth Congregational United Church of Christ, Reverend Raylan Hagler, senior pastor. I want to stay less than 4 minutes. First of all, I think the most important thing for us to understand about Walmart is we need to be informed and educated about what it means. Okay? To that extent, I have some flyers here about a movie called Walmart, The High Cost of Low Price. Yep. It will be shown this Friday at Plymouth Congregational United Church of Christ at 6:30 p.m. The church is located at 5301 North Capitol Street, Northeast. All right, so make sure you learn these flyers. Secondly, we are working on several things to educate the community about Walmart and the invasion of Walmart and the danger that it proposes to this city, across the city. To that extent, we're working on inviting a woman to come speak here in Washington, D.C. She's the author of a book called Selling Women Short, the Landmark Battle for Women Workers' Rights at Walmart, Lisa Featherstone. Also working on bringing a woman to D.C. named Reverend Betty Duke. Remember that name, Reverend Betty Duke, Pittsburgh, California. She is the original lead plaintiff in the lawsuit against Walmart for gender discrimination, the largest class action lawsuit in the history of this country. Reverend Betty Duke began working for Walmart back in the 1990s, and she was discriminated against. In this book, the author talks about Reverend Betty Duke and some other women and what has happened to them over the years. We need to understand what it means to have more than 1 million women for over a 15-year period to suffer different types of discrimination based on gender in terms of pay, denied promotion, etc. Yep. We need to know what that means. Secondly, we need to know what it means when you can go to Walmart and pay $2 for a five-pound bag of potatoes or $1 for a pound of carrots, but yet the community around you has been destroyed in terms of gentrification and all that that means. It makes no difference to me if I can go to Walmart and pay $2 for a pound of potatoes if I can no longer afford to live in my community because I've been forced out. I don't want to crawl over my neighbors who own their own business and they've been there all their lives and they have to close because Walmart now unfairly undercuts their prices. We need to know what that means. Lastly, and with all due respect for the organizations here who talked about Walmart and how they want to bring Walmart in, with all due respect, the reason why Walmart is so controversial is because they make billions of dollars.
Yep.
By underpaying their employees, by forcing people to work off the clock, by forcing them to work overnight or late at night. We need to ask questions. We need to know what kind of questions to ask. Okay? Lastly, let me make this real quickly. For the groups that here are, that are supporting Walmart or supporting the developer of Walmart, Walmart is notorious for buying friends.
Ooh.
I'm going to be real clear because we're in the house of God. All right? I don't want to pay $5 for a shirt and destroy my neighbor's livelihood. If that's not illegal, at least I know it's immoral, according to my Bible.
Ooh.
Somebody say amen.
Amen.
One in Europe, they're putting in 80,000 square feet of space on the second floor. Why in the world would you want to put your space on the second floor when first floor is a prime area? I don't know, beats me.
Can I answer that?
It sounds really good, that first floor, 80,000 square feet, divided by maybe 22,000, 3,000 square feet to attract house, retailers and restaurants, but I don't know that many retailers or businesses will survive with having Walmart up there. So my guess is, it's just my guess, you may disagree, but if you can't find any tenants to occupy those first level of 80,000 square feet,
yep.
Walmart have a very justifiable answer to say, hey look, we tried to make this into a place where low coffee, where people could shop and enjoy all day, but it didn't work.
Yeah,
it didn't work. So rather than leaving it empty, so that makes the store 160,000 square feet, which would be very close to their prototype of suburban mall.
Is that when they bring in the guns?
I mean, totally won't bother.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know where my store is. It's on East Cap on 4th Street. But it's a great neighborhood. People say I won't be affected, but Walmart's 1 mile away. It's like Harris Teeter came less than 1 mile. They said I wouldn't be affected. My business went down. Imagine what Walmart would do when it actually pops up. My business will definitely go down. The money that I actually put into it, I can't sell and lose. So I'm very scared, so please take it in fact. When you bring in a Walmart, what it does to a lot of the mom and pop stores, a lot of these people work 9 days, 7 days a week, 14, 15 hours a day, 16 hours a day, putting their livelihood just to make money to survive. When you bring in something like that, it's going to wipe them out. And I thank you for this.
On the 25th of February, animal rights activists showed up at both the offices and the homes of executives associated with AstraZeneca and other Huntington Life Sciences customers. Huntington Life Sciences is a contract animal testing laboratory where undercover investigators have caught so-called researchers punching beagles in the face, dissecting live monkeys, and even falsifying test results.
AstraZeneca executives for the animals we will fight.
We always sleep at night.
AstraZeneca executives for the animals we will fight.
We always sleep at night.
For the animals we will fight.
We always sleep at night.
AstraZeneca executives for the cat and for the mouse.
We are coming to your house.
For the beagle, for the mouse.
We are coming to your house.
For the primate, for the mouse.
We are coming to your house.
For the beagle, for the mouse.
We are coming to your house.
AstraZeneca.
It sure didn't take long for protesters who made that promise at AstraZeneca's downtown D.C. offices to show up at the home of Brian Maloney, the Associate Director for Policy and Issues Management of AstraZeneca. Brian Maloney lives in a huge apartment building, so instead of sitting out front with bullhorns, protesters entered the building and gave out flyers to apartments all over, I believe it was about 6 floors of the building. And you can bet he had a lot of explaining to do the next day to all his neighbors about why they got flyers under their doors or under door knockers saying, quote, Brian Maloney and AstraZeneca is responsible for this, and showing a chopped up dead beagle puppy covered in blood from inside Huntington Life Sciences. Next, protesters showed up at the home of Mark Coyne, Director of Global Policy for Huntington Life Sciences customer Baxter, and he formerly also worked for AstraZeneca, the primarily targeted Huntington Life Sciences customer of the weekend. Outside his house, they brought out the bullhorn, simply to tell all the neighbors what Mark Coyne's been doing.
Good evening, residents of S Street! We just wanted to let you know that this is a community alert that your neighbor at 1006 F Street, apartment B, is a puppy-coin scumbag. His name is Mark Coyne, and he is
Baxter is a top customer of Huntington Life Sciences. Once again, your neighbor at 1006 S Street, Mark Coyne, is a puppy killer that contracts with Huntington Life Sciences. This is a neighborhood alert. Your neighbor at 1006 S Street is contracts with animal testing facility Huntington Life Sciences. He is responsible for the deaths of over 500 animals each and every day of the week. If you have an animal companion, please walk across this house with caution, because he might kidnap your dogs and put them inside Huntington Life Sciences. This is a neighborhood community alert. Your neighbor, Mark Coyne, is a puppy killer.
One of the neighbors remarked, Mark Coyne's really not all that popular. He's mean to animals, and he has a dog that he never walks himself. AstraZeneca, Baxter, Bayer, Sanofia Venice, all of you know what you need to do. You don't want protesters coming to your homes. Dump Huntington Life Sciences. Stop sending business to companies that torture animals to death.